Shrink Wrap Radio number 364, Exploring the Wild Feminine with Dr. Marilyn Steele.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Marilyn Steele, and we'll be discussing her 2013 book, which is titled The Wild Feminine, Stories to Inspire and Embolden. Marilyn Steele, PhD, is a Jungian psychologist, author, speaker, artist, mother, and grandmother. She says she grew up in Hawaii, a land of great beauty and native wisdom, where life is deeply intertwined with nature and its rhythms. She still considers Hawaii a place alive with the sacred feminine, her soul home. She visits as often as possible, she says. The early loss of her baby sister and later the death of her younger brother cultivated a deep compassion in her for suffering people and the mysteries of life and death. She reports that this drew her into a career in psychology. A stronger calling arose after the births of her children, several powerful visions, and a surprising passion for the emerging new science. When her four-year-old daughter complained in 1977, quotes, "I know all about history, what about her story?" close quote, Marilyn realized she was quite frustrated and annoyed at the then-current models of the self, which excluded women's experiences, perspectives, inclusive thinking and feeling, and core spiritual values. She dedicated herself to exploring and describing the science and spirituality of the self, informed by the archetypal psychology of the dynamic transformative feminine. She goes on to relate that during her career as a Jungian psychologist, Marilyn has spoken internationally, taught at numerous graduate schools, provided continuing education seminars on the topics of female psychology, the evolution of consciousness, and a revisioning of the self. Dr. Steele is dedicated to helping women access their wild feminine power and returning feminine power, creativity, and wisdom to the world. She lives in Northern California. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Marilyn Steele, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you so much, David. I'm delighted to meet you and delighted to be with you this morning.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show and to kind of discover you. I've been working with your daughter now for a couple of years on some of the CE courses that we've developed.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and then to discover that her mother is this wonderful Jungian. It's like this buried treasure that I didn't know about.
Oh, thank you. That's very, very kind. I've been hearing about you, too, via my daughter, so that's a good bridge for us.
Yes, well, that's good. And I guess partly due to her encouragement, I think you indicated, or maybe in an email she sent me, she indicated, partly due to her encouragement, she got you to kind of get off the dime and write down your wonderfulness in this book.
You know more about me from the backstory. Yes, she's a triple Virgo, and I'm an Aquarius. And some of these stories and dreams and visions I've been living with for decades. And you know, they always could be written a little bit better or in this form. And then there's the whole technology of putting the book together. So without her assistance, I really doubt that you would have a book in your hand. So I'm very, very pleased that she got me going and focused and grounded, and there it is.
Yeah, I'm glad she did too, because I think it's a real gift to us all. Mm-hmm. And we'll be getting into that as our conversation goes on. Now, you grew up in Hawaii.
Yes.
What was the impact of that upon the person that you've become?
Well, I think the main, well, you know, there's so many influences, and I don't have another beginning. That was my beginning, but But growing up in Hawaii, which is one of those places, even though the indigenous culture is not the dominant culture, when you're so close to nature and growing up with the rhythm of ocean and the feeling of the breeze and the mythology that everyone kind of speaks about in, you know, the stories that you tell around the campfire and the language, and everyone did hula and music. So I kind of got into my bones both the connection to wildness, you know, to nature and my love for nature, but also a place where the sacred feminine, one of the few places in the world, really, where it is still alive and well. And, of course, I didn't know that's what it was at the time, but that's what I got kind of infused into me on a cellular level, so I'm very, very grateful
It really comes through in your writing. Now, you strike me as someone who does not move in straight lines. I'm guessing that you did not go straight into a PhD program after graduating from college. And if I'm right about that, at what point did you decide to pursue a PhD?
Well, I want to just comment about Berkeley, being at UC Berkeley and wanting to go into psychology. And at that time in the late 60s, psychology meant experimental psychology with rats. And they said, if you want to deal with people, go to Los Angeles. So I got off of that road. Yes, I have definitely traveled a weaving path, a spiral path, a nonlinear path,
right?
A creative path, and I went back to school to get a master's degree in education, and fell in when I was a single mom and had two young children. And that kind of didn't take me far enough. I realized I had always loved psychology. I loved art as well, but it felt like in terms of making a living, psychology was a better bet. And I would do both my creative life and psychology. So that was in 1977. I turned back to psychology and began working, getting my master's, and then 1981 went to the Wright Institute to get my PhD. And because I was an adult at that time and I really had a vision and was very steeped in new consciousness thinking, the Wright Institute was perfect for me because it had a lot of spaciousness for visionary thinking and your own creative path. And I just didn't think I could do an APA. I knew I couldn't do a very structured psychology program. So that was a perfect way for me to get back into the PhD dream.
Yeah, and just for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Wright Institute, it was the R-I-G-H-T Institute for you, but its name, if anybody wants to Google it, is W-R-I-G-H-T.
Yes, thank you, David. Yeah. And actually, the W-R-I-G-H-T Institute is now APA accredited and much more structured than it was in the early 80s. So just to warn people who want to do that research. But it was perfect for me at the time. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, at what point did you become interested in Jungian psychology?
Oh, I was always interested in Jungian psychology. That was part of my own personal path as an artist and a creative person and someone who was really trying to find a feminine footing in the world. It felt like Jung was really the only one who had the soul of it, you know, and such honor and respect for the feminine. And I would go to these conferences. Oh, that was a wonderful period of life where we go to these Jungian conferences all over the place, you know, down south. And you'd meet the most interesting, peculiar, unusual people, artists and writers and poets and psychologists. And I thought, well, this is really the path for me. And so it was more following the Jungian path that got me back to graduate school so that I could then go to the Jung Institute. So that whole path of getting back into graduate school was on my way to being a Jungian, which was the overriding dream of that.
Yeah. Now, so you did do work at the Jung Institute, but you didn't become an officially, quotes, Jungian analyst. Is there anything that you have to share around that?
Yeah, I would like to say, yeah, I did get into the Institute in 1992, very exciting. And I was there for 6 years of active training and then 2 years on leave while I tried to figure out what to do. And, you know, it really surprised me. It was a very rich, very in-depth education and time of personal transformation. And this is a really the Jungian piece of it, you know, the self, big S, the soul path is not always what you think you're going to be doing.
Right.
So I did have a linear goal, which is go to the Institute and go through all the hoops and become an analyst. And I was very attached to that. I spent a long time getting there.
Yeah.
So it took many, many experiences, but mostly the dreams. So you probably know from reading my book that I pay a lot of attention to my dreams and I take them seriously and they speak, you know, quite passionately to me. And it became clearer and clearer that I was supposed to get off of that path of becoming an analyst, that I was losing a part of myself that I really needed in order to leave. So it surprised me, and I hung on for dear life for a couple of years, and then a couple of things happened, one of which was that I got cancer. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was because I was holding on so tight. But anyway, you know, it caused me to really look at my life and see what I felt was the healthiest road forward. And it was to leave the Institute. So by the time I left, I did so with a great deal of gratitude and a great deal of clarity. So I'm very, you know, I gained so much from the training, but it just, that was not my road to become an analyst.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I think it was very courageous of you to be able to let go. I'm sure that there was a point at which that wasn't easy at all, although it sounds like eventually you were able to do it without regret.
Yes, a great deal of help, and I had a couple of wonderful analysts, too.
Yeah. Now, the title of your book, we keep talking about your book, the title of your book is The Wild Feminine. So that begs the question, what do you mean by the wild feminine?
Yes, good question. Okay, so the wild feminine is kind of my shorthand for, in Jungian terms, this would be the archetype of the dynamic, transformative feminine, who is creative, who has visionary power, who's transformative. And that comes from the work. I first discovered the dynamic, transformative feminine from Gareth Hill. So to give him credit, he's a wonderful Jungian analyst. So it's an archetype that we're not very familiar with. We know the Great Mother, who is static feminine, you know, the nurturing, the caretaking, the all-containing, but the static one. And we do not have, as individuals, but really as a culture, much room or appreciation for the wild feminine, who's creative and dynamic and transformative, part of the evolutionary consciousness, part of the sacred, too. So another longer term for the wild feminine is the wild and sacred feminine. And that's the term that's used more in eco-psychology, but that also fits.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, natural and free and beyond conventional bounds and beyond caretaking alone.
Well, it all comes through in your book and your writing, I must say. So
glad to hear that.
Yeah, anybody who's puzzled and wondering what you're talking about really should read your book. Because it is so poetic and the wildness comes through. How do you personally know when you're in touch with your own inner wild feminine?
Oh, that is a good question. As you know from reading the book, I'm going to have to circumambulate around this question here. As you know from the book, it's not a linear book. There are kind of different ways that I find my way into the wild feminine because it's not a, you know, it's not a category and it's not a, body of knowledge. It's an experience, and how I know it in myself is when I feel energized and natural, and I feel free. Part of this comes from actually being in nature, but it's more the experience of being in touch with my own creativity and feeling kind of inspired and in touch with myself and free. Oh, it's very playful. That's the other aspect of it that I really enjoy and want to pass on to people. Is the wild feminine is very playful. Very playful. Mm-hmm. So that part of the creativity. So it's when I feel most like myself. And, you know, people's wild feminine is going to look different. That's very important. I was thinking this morning that you might ask me, and since you haven't, I'm going to suggest an answer anyway, of maybe a couple of cultural figures, you know, women who I think of as the wild feminine.
Yeah, good idea.
And, well, the two who came to mind are Adele, who's a singer, you know.
Yes.
And if you've ever seen her interviewed, it's not just because she has this wonderful voice. She's totally free and open in her voice, but she's also quite a raucous, humorous, irreverent mm-hmm. person. She's just completely herself and happy to be herself. And the other person who came to mind is quite a different personality, Elizabeth Warren, who's a senator from Massachusetts. And she's, you know, kind of more of a bookish person, but she has her voice. She completely is centered in her own authority and speaks from that voice without apology. She's very clear. She's not aggressive. She's just naturally, you know, channeling Elizabeth Warren. So mm-hmm. those are a couple of details.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your advice to listeners who want to develop or to be in touch with their wild feminine?
Mm-hmm. Buy my book.
Right.
Well, I would really encourage women, and you know, it is an archetype, so technically it's also available to men. It's more available to women, but men, especially creative men, when you touch into your creativity and you listen for that still small voice and you begin to open to the possibility that there's more to life than what you see in ordinary realms, that there's something quite magical, and you begin to attune and just make space for synchronicities and intuitive hunches and begin to trust that energy a little bit, then you're beginning to follow the river of your wildness. And we all have it, and it makes life quite a different, qualitatively different, and can transform your life to just begin to listen to your dreams, be in nature.
Yes.
And express yourself, you know, because it's a very creative energy and it needs to be expressed, whether you dance it or you write it or you sing it or whatever it is, to give expression to that energy. When you feel enthusiastic, you know, when you feel inspired and kind of divinely inspired, trust that energy in you, whatever it is for you. That is your wildness. And that'll get you in touch with your soul, which is kind of what this is about.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to what you're saying and feel like I have had those sorts of experiences. Mm-hmm. But there are times when I feel closer to it and other times when I feel more distant from it. And reading your book, of course, reawakens the desire to be closer to it.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that. And of course, it is kind of a hide and seek thing. It's not constantly there, but important to seek it and express it, because isn't it a wonderful feeling of aliveness when you're there?
Yes, I like your expression there, that it's a hide and seek thing. That's nice. Now, you write so poetically and beautifully, and I would love for our listeners to get a taste of your writing. So I wonder if you'd be willing to read for us your short chapter that's titled Listening with the Ear of Your Heart.
Oh, I'd be delighted to, David. Thank you. Okay, so here's the story, Listening with the Ear of Your Heart. All month, a stag has been here, clicking down the wooden stairs to stride down the middle of Shasta Road, kingly, or lying in the pile of red and orange leaves on top of the garage roof, noble gaze of shining onyx, surveying the ordinary world with dignified reserve. His olive gray fur blends into the gnarled root branches of the dead rosemary as he polishes his antlers, making the hanging bushes bounce. Now he sits, watching, still, until I move into the kitchen and he closes his eyes, slowly chewing. He has appeared like magic, like the answer to an unasked question. Yesterday, he was lying comfortably under the kitchen window next to the coiled green hose, just outside the French doors. I think he enjoys jazz. Susanna McCorkle was singing Cole Porter tunes. He was still there an hour later, listening to Don Pullen on piano. Evidence of Things Unseen was the tune. I wonder if he is one of the twin fawns 3 years ago who woke me up at dawn, chasing each other in a nimble game of tag as their mother, annoyed, nipped at their white flag tails. His antlers, reminiscent of the world tree, connect us to the spirit of sky, body of earth, and underworld where we are rooted. In Celtic legend, his antlers acted like divining rods to find the energy lines of the earth. Isn't that our task, too, to align ourselves, our personal energies, with those of the earth? Some of the worst effects of the mining and drilling practices of industry have created imbalances in the earth's grid, interrupting and blocking earth's energy flows. What holes have been drilled into our own lives? What cutting of mountains and clearing of forests have moved us away from our energy? I think of the headaches, the sinus infections drilling me for months, making me attend to the place right behind my eyes, the blocking of my third eye sight. Maybe I need to grow some antlers as protection for my eyes, as antenna to the spirit world, or at least use some of the glucosamine in them to boost my immune system. This morning, the stag was snuffling through the birdseed on the patio bricks, finding the corn. He paused to rub his black satin nose across his olive green flank. Then his head was up, listening, nostrils quivering. Perhaps it is my reflection that has put him on alert, or the grinding of the coffee beans. I pick up an organic Fuji apple and roll it towards him, gently across the ground. My yard is now fenced on three sides by neighbors. One is a chain-link fence that closes off a barren backyard full of machinery, tools, car parts. Nothing lives there. Feels like a prison yard. What kinds of unnatural borders are drawn around the world? Lines deciding where you belong, who the enemies are, where the wars will be cast. I struggle for breath. This green hillside and red stone patio, a shrunken refuge, retreat, hideaway for the remaining city crowded wild animals, and me, sacred ground, the ground where inner and outer realities overlap, the place where we are both embodied and holy. The stag moves easily between the living and the dream world, especially at Samhain, the Celtic New Year. This is the time of no time, when the veils are thinnest. His place is at the edge of wildness. Sometimes he sits at the top of the stairs outside, where I can see his antlers gently swaying as I walk up to the house. The other morning, as I headed down the stairs to my car, he was there watching the street. Calmly, he looked up at me, his legs gracefully folded underneath. I began to talk to him, explain how I was sorry to disturb him, but I had to go to my office. The only way to my car was down these stairs. He didn't move. I didn't really want to go to the office, or perhaps into the world, the marketplace. I was at the third step down before he moved, and I'm not sure it was a threshold I should have walked over. Can I remember what is holy? Bring this beauty and magic into that other ordinary world. The stag has shown me the way to proceed before, appearing in a dream 30 years ago. I had one of many nightmares about being all alone, a divorced single mother, lost, when the dream began. I'm in a city multi-level parking garage with low ceilings, concrete floors, and steel cage lifts. I couldn't find my car or my keys. After going up and down all the levels, I finally left the garage and the city and wandered out into the undeveloped grassy land behind the buildings and houses. I was looking in the tall yellow grass for my keys, digging with a stick, when a stag silently revealed himself to me, slowly, like magic appearing out of nowhere. He lowered his great, gentle head, and with his antlers pointed to the ground to show me how to search for the way, his antlers antenna to the spirit world. Without words, he said, "Listen with the ear of your heart, and you'll find your path." Turning to the voice of the earth, the voice that beats in the deep pulse of the womb of the earth, listening to our own inner voice is the way to proceed for us all. There we find the seeds of new life. Every single culture in the world originated in shamanism, yet we've been so cut off from our own creative, transformative energies, the wellsprings of wisdom. Turning down to the mysteries of the dark and our deepest hearts, we find ourselves beating with the heart of the world. The world of human integrity is a green world. We must learn how to restore vitality to our desiccated souls. After an unleashed dog chased the stag up the hill yesterday morning, I feared he would not return. But last night, I heard him crackling through the dry, slick oak leaves, the clunk of a hoof against a rock. The full moon shone like a pearl, faintly pink, over the lace of the eucalyptus tree. I imagined his horns silhouetted as the tree of life, holding the moon like a cradle. Tomorrow, the rays of the rising sun will slide over his antlers like honey. In this long season of darkness, he comes as messenger, walking with our ancestors' souls, the laws of the land, the law of love. As I take my tea and plate of honeyed bread out to the patio, I see the stag pawing the dust under the Queensland pittosporum tree, making a bed to nap. While I sit reading and writing, he rouses himself, moves slowly behind the rosemary bushes and down the stairs. I hold my breath, keep my eyes down. Click, click, over the patio bricks, his black nose moist, his eyes steady. He lowers his head to the ground for the corn, then up to the table where I sit. I can see out of the corner of my eye the lichen-like covering between his horns, but it's not green, it's gold, speckled with gold. His tongue comes out to lick the glass tabletop for the corn I have laid out. His head is bent to keep the antlers out of the way, but they are also bent towards me, lending me his fearlessness, this spiritual pathfinder, this gentle warrior who integrates masculine and feminine energies, showing me that life's mysteries, usually hidden, want to be seen and known. We seek a wild peace.
Wow, that is just so magical.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you share that with our listeners, because there's no way that I could adequately describe it. There are so many things that we could comment on and discuss in that chapter that you've read. Certainly your attention to detail, the details of nature and the specificity of your descriptions really put us there.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's really quite wonderful.
Thank you.
I love the chapter title, Listening with the Ear of Your Heart. Can you say more about what you mean by that and how one might learn to achieve that?
Yes, well, you know, that was the gift of the dream. It's the way that the stag spoke to me. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard that phrase before, listen with the ear of your heart. But I knew what he meant when I dreamt it. And since then, I've learned a little more about it. I've I've heard it. I mean, there are energy lines in the earth, for example, which I was not aware of when I had this dream, that old cultures, Celtic and old shamanic cultures, there are lines of energy apparently in the earth to follow. My understanding of listening with the ear of your heart as is that we have to go deep and get close to the ground. It's not a listening upward into the sky and into our concepts and our abstract reasoning and in all of those ways in which our mind loves to be busy. It's really getting down into our bodies and into the earth and into our deepest heart, you know, to tell the truth about what we love and what matters to us. And the path comes outward from that.
Wow. Yes.
Sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the subtitle of your book is Stories to Inspire and Embolden. And I want you to feel free to throw in any stories that come to mind during our conversation, whether they're in the book or not. Okay.
Okay.
And I have the impression that your book is written to inspire and embolden women, and you already commented on this, at the same time that men can benefit from reading it as well. What would you hope that men would take away from it?
Oh, good question. I do hope that, that some men do find their way to this book and find something to inspire them. I really would hope that men would find a way to connect to their souls and really celebrate their creativity and their tenderness, which is there, but there's just such a, especially in this culture, especially in the American culture where it's, you know, it's thinking and extroverted and you have to be tough and you have to know all the answers and you're in your head and you're very intellectual. I would really hope that it would give, I don't know whether inspiration and embolden is the right word for a male reader, but more kind of permission and the pleasure of it, because it is a pleasure to be in nature. It is a pleasure to know what we feel and to express our hearts. It's a real joy to do that. And so I would hope that they find secretly or openly, you know, reading the book alone or sharing a conversation with others, that it's more than okay to speak from your heart and to slow down and listen to what your soul is trying to whisper to you and to let your, really the pace, you know, the pace of these stories and versus the pace of our work life, you know, usual American culture work life. It's like, wow, to slow down and really take in nature and then begin to tune into what you're truly feeling. Yeah.
Yeah.
You get permission to do that and that it's really a worthy thing. Not only is, I mean, it's crucial. It's like crucial for your own survival and for the survival of the planet. Well,
yeah.
Here my passion. I feel about this so strongly.
In this respect, maybe you can talk to us about lunar consciousness versus solar consciousness, which is something you touch on in the book.
Yes, I can't remember which story, but it kind of goes through all of it. So in lunar consciousness, you're looking for a ripening. The sense of time is very, very different. Your lunar consciousness is diffuse. We're looking, you know, widely and broadly. And when you think about what the moon does, you know, all the different phases of the moon always changing, sometimes going dark for 3 days dark and then coming back. So the light is not as scorching. Solar consciousness, which is more, especially in this culture, what thinking is like, it's like a laser beam. So rather than diffuse and contextual light that shines a light over everything just a bit, solar consciousness is focused and linear, but really scorching. So if that's the only light that you use, it's kind of like using a magnifying light. You know, you take the light of the sun and you put it over the grass. I feel like that's what's being done to our world is so much solar consciousness that we're just scorching the heck out of our world, both spiritually and environmentally. But the idea of ripening in lunar consciousness is very important because it connects our inner sense of things and rightness to an outer. We get connected to the outer world. We're not just stuck in our heads with this unrelenting, speedy, focused linear thinking. Lunar consciousness kind of opens you up to seeing what the rightness of action is given the time. You have to kind of tune in and listen in a different way to the rightness, to the quickening of a situation or the ripening of a decision. It's a thoughtful way of proceeding. And just to put in a little political economic note, you know, if we'd had a little more lunar consciousness and much, much less solar consciousness in 2008, I think all of those terrible, reckless, speedy economic decisions would have been quite different if we'd had more women who were listened to and making the thoughtful decisions, casting a wider light over the whole situation, over the pattern of the situation, rather than just one pointed light. The decisions are much more in harmony. Harmony is another part of lunar consciousness, harmony from inside to outside.
Yes, a kind of pun occurs to me that lunar consciousness is very reflective.
Yes, it's reflective. Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
This is the moon.
This is the moon. Reflective. Exactly. Yeah. Yes, perfect. That's right.
Some of your chapters start off with quotations, and one of the ones I particularly like is this one, quotes, "We must come to the end before a new beginning can come to us," close quote. Mm-hmm. And that's a woman I've never heard of. I didn't know this name, Helene Cixous? How would you say that name?
Yes, Helene Cixous. She's a French philosopher and poet. Oh. Yeah. And,
Yeah, so maybe you can expand on that a bit. I mean, I really like that.
I'm glad that spoke to you. It's been one of my favorites for quite a few years now.
Yeah, we must come to the end before a new beginning can come to us. Tell us about that in your life.
Yes. Well, you know, the first thing that came to mind was a cultural thing is I think we're at the end.
You know,
I think, well, I know. And some people read that quotation. I've used it in teaching a lot. And they think it's very dark and very depressing. And I don't see it that way at all. And maybe it's because I've gone through so many endings in my own life. And some of them were absolute wipeouts, you know, really just absolute wipeouts. But without an empty space, and this is kind of a Buddhist idea, very, very Eastern, I think, without the empty cup, there's no way for God or the self to come in and fill your cup up with something new. So you really have to, like, drink the cup down to the dregs. I think Jung says something about that, you know, about getting to the end of a complex or a stage in life. You have to really, really drink it down to the dregs, and that's the end of things. You can't just kind of leave it midway and change course. You have to complete things. And when you complete, let me think of my own life. When I completed a chapter, say leaving Berkeley, which I did 3.5 years ago now, and I'd lived in Berkeley for almost 50 years, from UC Berkeley and first marriage and raising kids and second marriage and graduate schools and 4 different houses, you know, bought and sold and
wow,
and my practice. So many lives, and they were all in Berkeley. And when my practice began to kind of shrink with the recession, but it was also shrinking with my energy, you know, it was one of those messages. And then I realized, gosh, I think it's time to sell my house. And it was a completely new landscape. It was really an ending of so many things. But without that, and so to kind of make the threshold between that, and I do call it the great wipeout because that's what it felt like at the time. It was rather insane. And I decided one of the ways to make a change, I was pretty sure I wanted to come to Marin. It was either Marin County or Maui. But my kids are all here, so, you know, grown kids with their family. So it was going to be Marin and not Maui. But I thought I better take a trip. This is a big threshold I'm crossing. And so I decided to take a trip in honor of the ending and to make space for a new beginning of what I did not know, you know. So I went to Costa Rica for 3 weeks and did a wonderful, very ecological, you know, adventure all over the place. Because I wanted to, I knew I was going someplace in my life that I had never been before. It was a new beginning and I didn't have a map. And I thought, well, I think I'm going to just get used to that by traveling to some place that I've never been before and doing some things that I've never done before.
Like, such a genius idea.
It was inspired. It was my intuition. But it was completely right. And I did some things that I'll never do again, like zip lining. I'm really glad to have done it once. But and you know what else happened? The other high point, there are many stories about Costa Rica, of course, and opening up to a new beginning. But I had the privilege of seeing a nesting leatherback turtle. It was one of my life's dreams to see a nesting turtle, and we were very fortunate to do that. It was the end of the season, but this leatherback was nesting. We watched her lay her eggs at night in the dark, maybe 100 eggs. She's huge, 6 feet across, and probably weighed 1,000 pounds. Wow. I mean, it was a really numinous, awesome experience. So when I came back, I needed to draw her and paint her. So she kind of, that experience with the real turtle in waking life led me back into my painting, which I had not done for almost 30 years. And the painting, which is the cover art on the front of the book, is one of the paintings that I did of her. And this is a particular one, and this is the part of the, you know, ending must come before a new beginning can come to us. You don't seek it and find it. It's more a revelation that mm-hmm. finds you. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at turtle books, and I had all of these wonderful photographs and, you know, people who work with turtles and trying to make a painting. And I just hated the painting that was coming out. I could barely go into the, I was at a class and I sat in my car and I thought, I cannot face this painting again. It is just not working out. And I want to do honor to the leatherback. It's just ugly and not working. And I don't know how to paint it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I said, well, Marilyn, you've already paid your money for this class. You might as well go up. And if you have to leave in 10 minutes, then you can do that. But you're here, you've got your paints, you've got your canvas, go do it. So I'm looking at this picture of the leatherback and I just decided to paint it out. The thing with oil paints is you can start all over whenever you want. So that's what I was doing with my life, right? Just like start all over, paint this one out. So I took every color I could think of and a couple of brushes, and I just completely freely, I think there was music on, as I recall, I may be making this up, but as I recall, there was music on, there was jazz, and I just kind of moved across the canvas because I was painting it out so that I could begin again. But then I, thank goodness, paused at the end of that, and I looked at what I had painted out, and because it was so, and that's the painting that is on the cover of my book. I let go. I let go of my plans, my schemes, my expectations, my linear goals. I just let go, and something came through me. So that was the new beginning that came to me, and so I have that painting to remind me when I get stuck on my plans and my goals and expectations that also I have to let the beginning come to me, that my job is to make space for it and to pay attention, you know, and follow it and take footsteps, but not to get so ego fear constricted that I can make something happen. So that's my long comment on that wonderful quote from Helene Siu.
Well, I'm so glad I asked you about that.
Oh, thank you.
It's a wonderful comment. Now, on page 75, there's a line of yours that I particularly love. And it was, you said, we carry the ashes of stars in our bones. We look out through seawater. Just the conjunction of those two, of the stars, you know, which there's the Joni Mitchell song of about were stardust and but then looking out through seawater, we know our bodies are largely saline, and the marriage of those two was so poetic. I just found it very moving.
I'm so glad you like it. And isn't it a wonderful thing to know? You know, when I first read that about that we have the ashes of stars in us, I was just ecstatic. It's like, it's true. So it's not, you know, just an alchemical idea and Jungian idea that we have the stars within us. We actually do. We actually do come from the stars. And there we are, you know, in the ocean. So I'm glad it came out in a poetic way that touched you, because it's just quite,
Yeah, it really did. Now, in one of your chapters, you talk about keeping a picture on your wall of Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai.
Yes, Wangari Maathai. Mm-hmm.
And I was not familiar with her work. You write that she started something called the Seven Trees Movement. I'm probably not alone in not knowing about that. Maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
Well, I would love people to be aware of her work, Wangari Maathai. She died a year or two ago. But she started, and actually my title of the story is Seven Trees because she began with seven trees, but the movement is called the Green Belt Movement. So you can look it up that way, the Green Belt Movement. But she started, well, there's a wild woman for you, my goodness, if we need another example. Because she was educated in the States, went back to Africa, and she saw the connection between the violence that was being done to women. She had experienced this also in her own life with an abusive husband who she had left. But she saw the violence that was being done to people as intertwined with the violence that was being done to the environment, and she helped the women, empower the women, and gave them something to do. And everyone's the government agencies, oh, you can't do that, and you're not a botanist, and they don't know how to plant trees, and you can't do it, to try and reforest the really decimated landscape that was being chopped down for firewood, and then you have floods, and you know the land was really. So she taught the women to plant trees, and they started with seven trees. And now I forget how many hundreds of thousands of trees have been planted. So in the process, there's the re-greening of the environment, but it was also the repowering. Now, these women had something important to do, and they found their power, and they felt good about themselves. And so she was powering up the women while she was kind of repowering the environment. And she did win a Nobel Prize, I forget which year, and it was a peace prize, as I recall. So that was an interesting choice, because working with the environment and working to empower women does bring peace. This is a really important part of the wild feminine, too. It is in the service of peace for the world.
Well, that's a really inspiring story. And something else I didn't know about, I learned a lot reading your book, is the Rio Hamza. And I can't believe I didn't know about that. But tell us about the Rio Hamza and what that is.
Well, here's an admission. I know very little about the Rio Hamza. It was one of those synchronistic, I was listening to the radio, I was writing that chapter, and I just heard a news, maybe it was NPR, maybe it was just on a news show. And when I heard that story about the river beneath the river, it's like, oh my God, one, the synchronicity, but the image of it, isn't it marvelous? And no one knew it was there. This river that is as large as the Amazon, deeper.
And a couple, I think you said it's 2 miles beneath.
Yes,
beneath the river,
2 miles. But now I don't know how they found it, because I don't know.
It's wider. It's like wider than the Amazon.
Wider than the Amazon, and 2 miles beneath it. Yes. So this mysterious, the river beneath the river that no one knew was there, but it's been there all the time. And I thought, well, that is like us, isn't it?
Yes, I was going to ask you, what do you make of that metaphorically?
Yes, I do. That's why I think it struck me in the way that, you know, when you have a synchronistic experience or numinous, I mean, because I was listening to the news and I went, oh my gosh, because it just, struck me so deeply. It's like, I think we're like that. You know, we go along in our rivers of life and we kind of get used to, maybe we're the Amazon, maybe we're, you know, a little creek in the Sierras, I don't know. But we get used to the flow of our own river and we can see it and taste and we're used to it. But what if we have just deeper than we can even imagine? And I think we do. This deep, deep river of the soul, the thing that connects us to life and the universe. And there's so much depth in us. You know, Jean Houston, she's another wild feminine woman. Do you know Jean Houston?
I know of her.
Yeah, yeah. And she's written lots of books and very much about the human potential movement. And she talks about, you know, kind of the parallel universes, the depths that we aren't aware of. But that's how it struck me. It's like, oh, I think there are rivers that we have no notion of, our depths and our power and our, you know, the deepness of us and the broadness of us. And it's going along whether we know it or not. And that's the good news, is that it is carrying us. It is a source of life for us. And it's very, very deep. I mean, I can't even imagine going 2 miles down to the earth. Can you? I haven't done exploring like that at all. So
no.
Yeah.
No, I can't. You know, that's such a nice, strong note. I think that's a good, strong note for us to end on. Is there any final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would like to, first of all, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to you. It's delightful to get to know you. And I would just like to encourage your listeners to pay attention to the still small voice within and to the energy and to let themselves have the playfulness, because it's really, creativity is very playful. It takes us to our soul, but it's very playful. So I would encourage you to let yourself play and take some time to be in nature and to be in your own nature, which is where your soul resides. And that's my final word about that.
Okay. Dr. Marilyn Steele, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure.
I hope this interview managed to convey some of the soul-making inspiration that I found in Dr. Steele's book. I hope you enjoyed her reading of the chapter on listening with the heart's ear. As you heard, her writing is poetic, evocative, and very passionate on such topics as nature, ecology, politics, inspiring women, the new physics, and soul making. In addition, the chapters track some of the major transitions of her life. Personally, I'm very impressed by her willingness to embrace endings and new beginnings, as in her decision to ultimately forsake her 6-year journey toward becoming a certified Jungian analyst. Nevertheless, she did conduct therapy for many years as a Jungian psychologist and therapist, and my sense is her clients were lucky to find a woman of her depth, sensitivity, and passion. I imagine they felt very supported in their own journeys toward the wild feminine. All of the chapters in the book are fairly short, about the length of the one you heard her read. The entire book is only 165 pages and includes a list of recommended readings, as if you needed more from those you hear here. As always, I hope you'll use the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar if you decide to buy this book. It's quite reasonably priced, I think, at US$13.44 for the paperback version or $9.99 for the electronic Kindle version.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I wanted to thank you for the remarkable podcast series that you've put together. I've been listening for many months now as I run, and I'm like a kid in a candy store. This is really a remarkable reservoir of information. I do have a check off to you, and I encourage everyone to think about how just valuable your service is. The book review aspect alone is incredible. It's really allowed me to focus on what I'd really like to read and buy and to glean the essentials of something that I might have interest in but perhaps not adequate time. As I mentioned, I'm a long-distance runner, and so I listen to you a lot. I find your podcast educational, entertainment, and kind of a secondhand therapy. One of the things I've learned from your podcast is that exercise is as good as meditation, so I guess I get a dose every time I go for a run. All kidding aside, it's just remarkable. It's a valuable service and a real gift. So I ask everyone to look into their heart, look at their watch and the time that you save them, and look in their wallet and make a contribution so that you can continue doing this good work. Thank you so much. As a full spectrum listener, I really appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you, Jan Prynne, for that very full spectrum appeal. I don't recall whether or not I've already announced that we do have a relatively new transcript on the site. It's for Shrink Wrap Radio number 361, Deep Blues with Jungian analyst Mark Winburn. And that transcript is due to the generosity of our listener and volunteer, Gloria Ullman. Be sure to let me know if you'd like to help out by transcribing one or more episodes. It's another way of supporting Shrink Wrap Radio, and it adds great value, I think. Let me remind you that we have a Shrink Wrap Radio app for both iOS and Android devices, and you can get all the information you need about those by clicking on the Apps tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. It's hard to believe that it was about this time of year last year that I was in Sweden to conduct a weekend dream workshop. It seems both so recent and so long ago. It's paradoxical. I had such a wonderful time there and made good friends with some of my listeners. I have fond memories of my time with Simon, who was my host, Oscar, Michelle, Anders, Irina, another host, Samanda, and others. I have no big trips planned for what remains of this summer, but I sure feel like I could use one. I'd love to do a weekend workshop in your area. In fact, I encourage you to click on the little text link in the right-hand sidebar on our site where it says, Weekend Dr. Dave Dream Workshop in your area. That'll connect you to some of my thoughts about that. And that's about all I can think of right now by way of announcements. So let's go on to the mail.
Hi, I'm John Fredrickson, author of the 2013 book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. And you're on the couch now with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, John Fredrickson, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's dig down into the old email bag for a few recent communiques from our listener community. First, we hear from Dan, who writes, Dr. Dave, I finished your episode regarding a dangerous method, learned a lot from various perspectives. Now I'm making my way through the recent and very endearing episode with Dr. Mate. I really appreciate this program. I'm currently a clinical social worker in the addiction field, and I'm also hoping to begin medical school next fall. I see you did your studies at the University of Michigan, but that's where I did my graduate studies. Go Blue! And that's from Dan. Boy, this letter seems so familiar, I'm wondering if I might have read it before. But at any rate, I'm really glad to hear from you, Dan, and particularly since you did your graduate studies at the University of Michigan, as did I. And as you say, go blue. Actually, I'm getting together for lunch this very day with a friend who got his MSW and PhD in social work at the University of Michigan. But that probably would have been long before you did your graduate work there. Here's another one that reads, Hello, just wanted you to know that you have listeners in Serbia, too. I have been listening for a while, so I decided to send you an email just to show you that you have listeners all over the world. Best wishes. And that's signed Soul Loot, which is an interesting moniker. You know, I'm aware that we have listeners all over the world, but I don't think I knew that Serbia was on the list, so I really appreciate getting that news. Somehow it gives me a lift to know that there are people in other countries that are listening, because, geez, it's just kind of a special privilege. Here's one that starts out, "Hi, Dave, listen to your interview with Richard Creighton. Very fine. I don't know what your connection is with Saybrook anymore, but I'm working on a dissertation through Saybrook. Creighton's book on Herald dreams was referred to me by Robert Bosnack. You cats are all older than me, so I look up to your writing and interviews. Thanks, Jeff." Well, Jeff, I am an older cat, and I'm glad to be lumped in with those other older cats that you recommended or that you mentioned. And it's nice to be looked up to. So I really am glad to hear from you. Here's another that also refers to the interview with Dr. Mate. It says, "Hi, Dr. Dave. So glad you got an interview with Dr. Mate. However, there doesn't seem to be a way to listen to it, just the transcript. Could you check this out?" And I did check it out, and I think I fixed whatever the problem was. It's been a little while now, but I assume that problem went away. And the writer, who is Crystal, goes on to say, "Other recommendations, Philip Moffitt, whose bio is former Esquire magazine CEO. Philip Moffitt left his successful publishing career at the age of 40 to embark on a path that led him to become a Buddhist meditation teacher, and he founded the Life Balance Institute, where he trains executives and individuals in skillful living. He is co-guiding teacher at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California and the author of two books, Dancing with Life and Emotional Chaos to Clarity." Well, he does sound like he might be an interesting guy. And she also recommends Jan Crawford, recent author of The Disorderly Soul, and Will Kabat-Zinn, she says, son of you-know-who, who is now a meditation teacher and psychologist. Can't wait to listen to Dr. Mate, Jessica Grogan, and also the Jungian analyst. I've fallen behind, she says, exclamation point. And that's from Crystal in Seattle. And Crystal, by now you will have heard that interview with Dr. Mate, and I'm sure you will have liked it. And I really appreciate the recommendations that you've given for these three possible guests. I have added them to my ever-growing list of possible guests, and who knows, I might get around to them. And here's one more that reads, Dr. Dave, thanks so much for what you do. I'm a longtime clinician in the field of addictive disorders. I like your podcast, as you always have a fresh point of view. And that's from Todd. And Todd, thanks so much for your encouragement. I hope to continue to bring you podcasts with a fresh point of view. And my point of view, often I'm not terribly explicit in sort of preaching about what my point of view might be, but hopefully it comes across in the selection of guests. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. And also, if you get our Shrink Wrap Radio app that I mentioned earlier, there's a way to message me directly from that app. So thanks to Dr. Marilyn Steele for her insights into the wild feminine. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with psychotherapist, trainer, and author John Fredrickson, MSW, and we'll be discussing his remarkable book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. Now, I interviewed John several years ago on my Wise Counsel podcast, and I can tell you he's a great guest. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.